When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
And the Admiral was standing behind his desk, and before I got two steps into the room, he screamed at me that I was the most dishonest, immoral son of a bitch he'd ever seen in his life.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Bill Woodman is a former US Navy nuclear missile submarine commander who shares his rich experiences from joining the US Naval Academy in 1964 to commanding two submarines, the USS James Monroe and the USS Alabama, during the Cold War. Bill opens up about his initial aspirations, rigorous training at the Naval Academy, and his challenging interviews with the legendary Admiral Rickover, who directed the original development of US naval nuclear propulsion and controlled its operations for three decades. He gives detailed insights into submarine operations, leadership challenges, operational readiness exercises, and the constant concern of being detected by enemy forces. We also delve into Bill's personal challenges and the pressures on submarine families, his final patrol commanding the USS Alabama, and reflections on movies and literature that accurately depict submarine life. I'm delighted to welcome Bill Woodman to our Cold War conversation.
My father served as a chaplain in the U.S. Navy in World War II. And even though when I was growing up, I tended to be landlocked, he always regaled me with the stories of his service in the Navy. And it was about that time I started envisioning myself on the bridge of a destroyer charging through the sea one day. And the Navy and the desire to service always had an appeal to me.
So you fancied yourself a bit in that Tom Hanks role in the, I can't remember the name of the movie now, the recent one where he's the destroyer commander in World War II.
Yeah, Greyhound.
It's the one. Yep. That's the one. So you weren't thinking about submarines at that point. You just wanted to be commanding a surface ship or something like that. Was that your aspiration?
Yeah, that was exactly my aspiration. And I would have been perfectly happy if that's the way it would have ended up.
When do you join the U.S. Navy?
Well, I reported to the U.S. Naval Academy in 1964.
What is the training like at the U.S. Naval Academy?
Well, it's, it's very regimented, of course, and back then it was all men. And it is strictly designed to produce Navy pilots, Navy surface officers, and submariners. And that's basically what it's in the business of doing. And the class size is always starts out about 1,400, and you just go from there. And it's about one half of the Navy's officer input each year.
And during that training, do they work out what sort of arm of the Navy you're going to be best suited for?
Well, it all comes down to your senior year when they have basically a decision night, and you've normally generated on your own towards either flying. And if you're going to be a flyer, you're going to go to flight school after that, and you have to pass physicals, and that's already known. And if you're going to be a surface officer, that is unknown. And basically what they do, they have a list of available billets, and they start with your class standing, and the first guy that wants to go surface gets a first choice. But in order to get to submarines back in that day, you had to go to an organization called Naval Reactors. And at the time, Naval Reactors was headed by Admiral Rickover. He was the father of the nuclear Navy, and you had to pass an interview with him. And I didn't even think of going submarines. Well, the real story is, I was at the Naval Academy. My academic standard was about in the middle of the class. And one reason why I was just middle of the class, I guess, was I was a member of the crew team. And that's a pretty heavy burden on your time and on your body. So I was perfectly happy thinking that I would just end up in the surface Navy. And besides, I had no aspirations of even thinking about having an interview with that Rickover, because he only took candidates from the upper 20% of the class. But my company officer suggested that I apply. And I thought to myself, well, you know, if I applied to nuclear power training, and that's what you had to do, you had to go through Admiral Rickover to get the nuclear power training in order to get into submarines. If I applied, I said, and they accepted me for the interview, at least I could maybe someday sit down and talking to a distinguished person that recording history, that I had in fact met the famous Admiral Rickover. So I applied and got accepted for the interview. And that in itself was a trial. But to make a long story short, he accepted me for his program, which really kind of blew me away. And that was the first time I thought about going submariners, was about 2 weeks before I had my interview with Admiral Rickover in my senior year at the academy.
Wow. Wow. I mean, Rickover is a legend. Well, just give me a bit more detail as to what that interview was like.
Oh, gosh. You may want to edit part of this. Like I mentioned, I was a crewman. And before you actually go in and see the admiral, you get interviewed by three of his associates. And these guys are brilliant. These are the guys that design the engineering plant and the reactor plant and reactor safety, and they really know their stuff. And there always seems to be one question that comes up, and that is, when is your first think about going nuclear power? Well, the usual answer tries to tend to, well, sir, it was shortly after conception, and in my mother's womb, I thought I would want to train in nuclear power and you know, that kind of stuff. And they got to me and said, well, when did you first think about going nuclear power? And I said, well, about 2 weeks ago, and my company officer suggested it. It turns out I took a lot of their ammunition away, because they couldn't criticize what my academic record was from the standpoint of, why didn't I take more of these courses or more of those courses? But I still had the issue of rowing crew. And when I got called in for my first interview with the admiral, he questioned me on it. And the question went along the lines of, hey, if the Naval Academy didn't have a crew team, would it you know, go away? And of course, I somehow blathered my way through that answer. And that interview was over, and I was dismissed from his presence. And the guy that escorted me in said, what'd you think about the interview? And I said, well, if the admiral was trying to get me to quit the crew team to join his organization, I was not interested anyway. So thanks very much. And all's said and done. And he says, wait here. He went back into the admiral's office, came out shortly, called me back in. And the admiral was standing behind his desk. And before I got two steps into the room, he screamed at me that I was the most dishonest, immoral son of a bitch he'd ever seen in his life. And he kind of repeated that three different ways, threw me out of his office. And I went and was escorted to another room where I sat all alone to contemplate my sins. Well, eventually, people came down to ask me what I had done to upset the admiral. And I don't remember much of those conversations, but, you know, about the fourth person that came down to ask me that same question, I looked very senior, and I said, Sir, I have to confess that my immorality is only surpassed by my confusion. At that point, he left the room, shut the door, and started laughing. I finally got escorted back to see the owner, and I was invited to, if I wanted to, speak to the admiral one more time, would I like to do that, that I have something to say. Well, I had no idea what I was going to say, but I said, of course, you know, I'm a midshipman, I'm ready to go, and you know, I know that the wrong answer was to say no. So I went in there having no idea what I was going to say. I went and sat down in the duty chair that you're supposed to go to and sit down. And the admiral spun around in his chair, looked me in the eye, and said, do you have something you want to say to me? And I said, yes, sir. And I had no idea what I was going to say, but that was not a problem, because then he berated me for about 3 or 4 minutes and kicked me out of his office and told me to write him a letter every month, which I did until I reported to Nuclear Power School. So that was my three interviews in one day with Admiral Rickover.
Wow. Well, he sounds like he lives up to my expectation as to what he'd be like.
Well, he exceeded mine.
Brilliant. So you move on to nuclear power.
Yes.
What's that like? You know, did you have an engineering background or a technical background?
I had a generic background. At the time, I was only required to take a minor. And I took a minor in operations analysis. And at that time, no one really knew what operations analysis was, but it sounded like a neat thing to understand. And it was heavy in math and things like that. So I had a fairly strong basic background. And the Naval Academy course of instruction, you know, covers physics and calculus and biology and things like that. So I had sufficient understanding to go to the course. But of course, the training under Admiral Rickover was 6 months of nuclear power school. And that's all classroom. And that was basically at the master's level. And it was intense. And I struggled hard, but I got through, not with a high class ranking, but I was able to go on to the next phase, which was 6 months of prototype training. And there are a number of land-based prototypes that the admiral had developed to test out his designs. And once the design testing was over, they were used to train and qualify the troops, officers and enlisted, in the actual operation of a nuclear power plant. And that was 6 months. And you had to pass a fairly extensive written and oral examinations in order to complete that. And I got through that. And that was a lot more exciting for me. It was hands-on. And then once you have finished that training, you were to go to submarine school. Submarine school for officers was usually 6 months long, but they were so short of officers for the submarine force that they had reduced the submarine school to 6 weeks. And the only reason they reduced it to 6 weeks is that's how long it took to process a physical to make sure that you were qualified to go onto a operating submarine. So it was a pretty long road, not very long, but a year and 6 weeks, just to step aboard your first submarine.
And do they vet you in terms of going on a submarine to just check your I don't know, psychological state of being in a confined space or anything like
that? Not that I'm aware of. About the only thing that they did was once you were just in the nuclear power school, they took you to a dive facility and put you inside a pressure chamber and pressurized the atmosphere. And I have no idea why, but it went up to about, oh gosh, I'm at maybe five or six atmospheres. Couldn't stay there very long. And then you're in this little cylinder, they turn the lights out. And then lights were out for, oh, maybe a minute, and they turn them back on, depressurize the chamber, and sent you on your way. And so as far as physically capability, you know, to see if your ears could take the pressure change, I guess, and existing in a small space with the lights out, that might be the only screening that I was aware of. Although I'm sure that, you know, if it was obvious that going through this extensive training that you were not progressing well, or your attitude was you know, really out of line, I saw nothing else other than that.
Do you think that was a Rickover recommended test then, putting you in a cylinder with the lights?
I have no idea. I think he was more interested in the engineering aspect and making sure that you were qualified to operate his reactors and not hurt him.
Yeah.
You don't want to do damage to a reactor. It has serious consequences.
Yes. So you're posted to the USS James Madison.
That's correct.
And what's your role there?
Well,
what do they let you loose on?
Well, my first assignment was as the communicator, but that was what I was supposed to get paid for. But the real challenge was to get qualified. And the first qualification you go for is engineering officer of the watch. In other words, you get qualified on the reactor plant and how to operate it. And that usually, that goes pretty quickly because after all, you've previously qualified on an operating nuclear reactor. And you just have to learn the systems that are involved with a submarine that are going to be unique to that class of ship. Then the next challenge is to qualify as officer of the deck. And eventually, when you got all that together, to qualify in submarines. And that usually takes about a year, sometimes longer. Mine took about a year. And that's a lot of knowing the systems of the entire submarine, knowing the operating procedures. You get to really know the boat. And the thought is I was going through all this training that, you know, whether I had been a surface officer or a submarine officer, I felt pretty confident that one, knowing the ship from stem to stern and knowing the operating procedures, both engineering and topsides, would have been important whether I'd been a surface officer or a submariner.
This is very similar to the Royal Navy, where you get your dolphins
right
after you've passed that training. And I think that the intention of this is to make sure that if there is some sort of emergency, you could work in whatever location that you were required to work in.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. Now, I guess you were quite lucky with the USS James Madison, because about, I think, a year after you left, it collided with a Victor-class submarine up in Scotland, didn't it?
That's correct. And I had been making patrols in Scotland, out of the Holy Loch on the Madison. And there was an AGI off the entrance there to the North Channel. And I imagine they had coordinated. And yeah, there was a little bit of a bump.
Did you find it easy to adapt to those long voyages submerged on the Madison?
I didn't find it particularly, that was never in the front of my mind, other than the desire to go home and visit my wife. But no, you kept so busy. There was so much to do. There was so much training to do, and that the time didn't fly by. But I learned very early on that the one thing I didn't want to be doing was to wish my life away. In other words, just dream about getting home. I really wanted to be as productive as I could while I was there and spend my time with hopefully with eventually good results here or to benefit and not just, you know, just dream about going home. You had to put that, you had to submerge that in your approach to life on a submarine and just focus on the mission and the training and in the operations.
And so with your training, was the ultimate aim was for you to become a commander?
Right. Yeah. One of the barriers that you had to overcome or do was whether you were going to be the engineer of a nuclear power plant. You had to qualify as a nuclear engineer. And that qualification meant that when you said you were ready, you reported to Admiral Rickover's office, which is referred to as Naval Reactors in Washington, D.C., and you sat down to an 8-hour pencil race or an 8-hour written examination. And I can guarantee you that every examination given in the nuclear power program, probably to this day, is not multiple choice questions. It's all write out and calculate and handwritten. And it's an 8-hour pencil race is what we called it. And I kind of knew that I could never pass an 8-hour pencil race, but I could answer one question at a time. And with that approach, I was able to get through. And then after you've done the written exam, you're interviewed at least two or three times, again, by the experts of naval reactors. So you have to qualify as an engineer. And then as you work your way up, I ended up being an operations officer navigator for my department head tour. And that meant going to school to learn how the ship's inertial navigators work and things like that. And that was a brief interlude before going back to sea as a department head. And then when you qualified and were selected for executive officer, second in command, then you had to go through XO school. And that was fairly extensive. That was probably about 6 months. Well, and you reported up to New London, Connecticut, where the submarine schools were, and went through a lot of training up there, learning how to do all the administrative stuff that you're going to have to deal with as an executive officer, and also getting some time, damage control trainers and things like that. And then when you are ready to become a commanding officer, you have to go through PCO training, prospective commanding officer training. And again, you go back to naval reactors and you spend 12 weeks reviewing your specific plant and all the nuances of that plant that your ship's going to have. And that again involves an 8-hour pencil race and interviews to make sure that you're ready to go, that you know your plant. And then you report to submarine school and you do a lot of simulator training on how to shoot torpedoes and go through scenarios to shoot torpedoes and things like that. And then you go to sea and you go out and you actually shoot exercise torpedoes. It's kind of like the Royal Navy's parachute course. You know, you put into situations where you're actually shooting at the warships or at submarines or simulated submarines, which is simulated by a torpedo that sounds like a submarine. So it's pretty extensive. And once you pass that, you're sent on your way and you take command.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War,
As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
You make it sound quite straightforward, but I can imagine there's a lot of pressure there, because with the Royal Navy Perisher course, the reason it's called Perisher is if you don't pass it, you're off submarines.
Right. That's right.
So is that the same case with the U.S. Navy?
Yes. I mean, if you really blow it, so to speak, you don't proceed onward. And what happens more often than not, if there is going to be a dropout, it's usually self-initiated by the individual dropping out. And I've seen that happen, maybe once or twice. One of my classmates dropped out for that reason. He just self-selected himself out of the program. He didn't feel that he was going to be fit for command. I don't know too many cases where people have been pulled out for poor performance, but I'm sure that's happened.
Right. How would you describe your command style, Bill?
Well, I can give you a couple instances. One of the things you did in PCO course, reflective commanding officer course, is you had to show your command policy, and it had to be in writing. And most of my classmates had command policies extended, 12, 13, 15 pages of handwritten procedures. My command policy was on one side of one sheet of paper. I met every member of my crew, and I always had one discussion with them. And it started out with, who is the most important man on the submarine? And we would go through that. And basically, the basic answer was, on the submarine, there is no most important man. Every man is required, must do his job to the best of his ability. If the navigator doesn't do his job, the submarine runs aground. If the engineer doesn't do his job, something breaks in the engineering department and he can't fix it. If the mess cook, the humblest job on the submarine, doesn't maintain good sanitary procedures, the crew gets sick. Everybody is required to do the best of his ability, the job he's assigned to do. Then having said that, I looked at him and said, okay, now that we agree on that, why do you call me sir and why do you salute me and call me captain? And that was a little bit harder. But eventually we got to the final answer, and the final answer was, the reason you call me captain and salute me is because I'm responsible for everything you do. And that's basically how it started, how I started with the troops. And one of my underlined items in my one sheet of command policy was, at all times, I expect you to tell the truth, no matter how embarrassing it might be, whatever. We're in a submarine. We have a mission to do. And if you make a mistake, for example, or if you don't, we need to know what happened so we can deal with it. So that's, I don't know. Does that give you an approach for my command policy?
Yeah, it does. I mean, base my view of submarines on the hunt for the Red October.
Okay.
I was expecting you to be a bit of a Bart Mancuso, the Scott Glenn character.
Okay.
How do you rate that film?
Yeah, it's been so long since I've seen it. Yeah, I thought it was, pretty good Hollywood. And it was a good story. It didn't really make a tremendous impression on me. The movie Crimson Tide about the USS Alabama made kind of more of an impression, because when Gene Hackman plays your role in life as commanding officer of the Alabama, I guess you've sort of arrived. But Yeah. I didn't think too much. I did meet Tom Clancy, the author. I happened to be a student at the National War College, and he came to speak. And he was an interesting character. And he had the ability to aggravate everybody in a room in short order, but he had great success as an author, and he really did kind of, I would use the term, prey on military officers in particular to try to get his data. In fact, I can tell you one story about him. One of our instructors at the National War College was sent to review the Hunt for Red October book. And his job was to, get an opinion, provide an opinion of the book. And he called Tom Clancy up and he said, "Hey, Tom," he said, "we need to talk." So they meet in Annapolis, Maryland. And Tom Clancy shows up with, literally a shopping cart filled with all his bona fides. And these are all the references he has to show that anything in his book comes from an unclassified source. So he's really uptight. And he was he was a Jesuit-trained individual anyway. He came in and John Byron, who was interviewing him, said, "Hey, Tom, I've read your book and there are two things in it that are classified." And Clancy goes ballistic. He starts going up and down. "What's that? Can't be. I got all these references." And he finally looks at John and says, "Well, what are they?" And John says, "I can't tell you. They're classified."
Brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant. He was brilliant.
He was able to get Clancy a little bit excited.
Amazing journey with Clancy. I mean, he was an insurance salesman, I seem to think.
Exactly. Yeah, I think he was. But boy, he was fascinated with the military.
Your first command is the USS James Monroe. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So being in command of a SSBN, a nuclear missile submarine, is there any extra vetting that you have to go through?
No, not that I'm aware of. By the time you've gotten there, so many instructors have seen you and you've had so many exams that if you're still there, hopefully you're good to go.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, things around like political beliefs and things like that, they didn't ask any questions around that?
No, never got interviewed on that. If you had a dark side, usually by then it was disclosed.
Yeah.
But again, not everybody that was selected for command went to command. And sometimes it was because the selectee said, "I'm not ready for it. I don't want to go." And then sometimes I'm sure it was based on political and religious beliefs.
Can you remember that first patrol where you are in command?
Well, I do. It was exciting. It was out of the Holy Lock. And I loved the adventure of going to Scotland. I mean, I was there one time and it didn't rain for 4 days. And people are still talking about that. Yeah, it was kind of exciting, that first patrol. You get to the point where, every time you've been on a submarine before, there was always someone you could turn to advice. And now all of a sudden, there's no one to turn to. You've got to make the decision. And that challenge certainly can be challenging at some times. But I'll tell you one story that came out of my first patrol. And that is when I got back off of the patrol and reported back to the group in Charleston, South Carolina. I was met by the chaplain who was he was senior to me. He was a full captain. I was just a commander. And he said, "Bill," he says, I hate to tell you this, but the dependents of your crew, the wives of your crew, really made a bad name for themselves. They were nasty to each other. They were nasty to other submarine officers' wives. They just did not do anything to their own credit other than to just be off, not support them. And I said, well, thanks, Jeff. I got the idea. And then I started thinking about that. And then I reflected on what might be the cause. And I remember distinctly that I was talking to my wife. And about that time, I had made maybe 15 patrols or so. And I mentioned to her that, gee whiz, honey, don't be upset with me. I leave for patrol in a week. And she looked at me and she said, your mind's already up with the boat. We're just waiting for your body to catch up with it. And as I thought about that, it occurred to me that there was something I need to tell the crew. So about 2 weeks before we went on the next patrol, I assembled the crew and I said, hey, look, guys, here's what's going on. We're getting ready to go on patrol. We're going to go on extended family separation. There's 100 days we won't be home. And for 72 of those days while we're at sea, we're not going to be able to communicate. And that's a hard time. That's a tough time. And we're going to go through this process of getting ready for that separation. And we're going to say, oh, this is terrible. I'm leaving the family. Da, 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 da. It's tough. I don't know. The Navy's making me do this and da, da, da. And I say, what's happening, guys, is that attitude that you're conveying to your dependents. Sometimes they pick up on that and they support and love you and they carry that attitude with them. And sometimes that doesn't serve well when they interact with each other or other family members or other members of the submarine community. I said, what you have to do, what you really have to do is you have to convince your dependents, however you do it, that you believe in the mission that you're about to undertake, that you really believe in it. And if you don't believe in it, you come see me and I'll get you off the boat. Nobody ever came to see me. I gave that same lecture every time before I ever went on patrol again. And when I came back off that second patrol, the chaplain met me and he said he couldn't understand why. It was like night and day. The dependents really supported and performed well. So that's the thing I remember most about that first patrol.
Wow. And you said there's no communication with the outside world while you're submerged. So the crew can't receive any messages from home or anything like that.
No, let me correct that. Now, I'll give you another. Well, this is sometimes I've had the occasion to address audiences about what's it like to be on a submarine. And I would tell them, well, if you're been an enlisted man, for example, you've had 10 years, you're an E6, you're for what they call a first class petty officer, and you're going to go and you're assigned bunk because you're fairly senior in the submarine ranks as far as enlisted go. You've got a mil bunk. And if you reach up above you, there's another guy above you. You reach below you, there's a guy below you. You reach across the passageway, there's three guys on that side. You reach up to your head, above your head, and there's three guys, in the front of you, and there's a bunch of guys behind you, and you got a little locker. And when you button up to go on patrol in the submarine, we're going to close the hatch, and you won't be able to breathe fresh air or see sunlight for the next 72 days. And you will not be able to communicate with your dependents, but they can send you a family gram. And back in those days during the Cold War, you could get up to 6 family grams of patrol, and it was limited to something like 28 words. and it was screened by the group to make sure there was no bad news. And that's the communications that you got. And by the way, while you're on board the submarine, you're going to be on watch for 6 hours. And then the other 12 hours, because you're usually standing one watch in three, you get to eat, you get to clean, you get to train, you get to drill, you get to do all these things. And we're going out in an environment that is not necessarily very benign. It can be very, very rough. And you know, it's the ocean. And that's what you have to look forward to. And by the way, if for example, you had somebody that was charged with a minor crime and told that he had to go to jail for 2 months, or he could go to on board a submarine and live like a submariner, he would refuse to go on board the submarine because that would be considered cruel and unusual punishment. So try to put that in perspective. And the difference is all centered around the mission and the purpose for being at sea. So, I hope that answers the question.
It does. And I guess you're using the sort of keeping them busy and focused to maintain their morale and mental well-being as well during those long periods.
Yeah, after doing all this, my thought was that if things are run right, the most bored person on board the submarine is the commanding officer.
That's a good point. How much did you think about the destructive power that you had on board and that you would potentially at some point receive orders to unleash that?
That's a very good question. And I don't know if the answer will surprise you or not, but I think to a man, you never really concentrated on that. You knew two things. You knew that if you ever launched your missiles, that you would have failed your mission because you no longer were a deterrent. You hadn't deterred anything. You failed as a deterrent. And the other thing, you probably realized that if you ever launched your missiles, you probably didn't have anything to go back to. So you just kind of accepted that as par for the course. That was part of the routine. And I'll give you another thing. A thought occurred to me when I was on board the Alabama in command. I was laying in my bunk one night. And I thought to myself, I'm shielded from a nuclear reactor by 24 nuclear tip missiles. And I got 400 feet of water above. And it's probably a mile and a half to the bottom below. And there are about 130 men on board, and I'm in charge. And I said, I can't think that way. I have a mission to do, and we just concentrate on completing that mission. And if we're successful, we get everybody home and train for the next time we go back to sea.
How often did you have to go through like weapons readiness tests and basically run through the procedure for a launch?
Well, a weapons readiness test called WSRT in a 72-day patrol, and that was about the average length of your alert patrols. When you're alert, you're in constant communication, receive only. You're waiting and you're ready to respond to that message you never want to get. But it periodically, at times, and I don't know how they picked it, it could be any time of the day or night, you get a message that tells you to respond to a weapon system readiness test. And you go to battle station's missile and you'd spin up the missiles. Then you get into a launch mode as far as the ship's characteristics are concerned, and you count down the missiles and go about your way. And in the process of doing that, all the data is recorded. The ship's data, the missiles data, everything is recorded and then sent back to be analyzed to see, in fact, if your missile battery was in fact ready, if the ship was in parameters, and if called to launch, that you were capable of doing so, And that determined the effectiveness of your weapon for the purposes of going to Congress and stating your case for why you needed funding and validating the purpose of your mission. Now, there were other tests that you had to look forward to. Once a year, as a minimum, you had to go through an operational reactor safeguards exam. And what that involved was, is you would, at the end of patrol, usually you'd bring the ship in, the ORS team, that's what they called it, operational reactor safeguards exam. The ORS team would board. It was composed of a former commanding officer, and he would have, as I recall, three post-engineer officers of other submarines and surface ships. And they would go through your entire engineering department. You would have basically every watch section would get drills. Then you'd have to, your paperwork would be analyzed and evaluated. You'd go through oral examinations. It was a two-day, very thorough examination. And that happened as a minimum once a year. And then about once a year, you'd go through a weapon system review to make sure that your procedures and reviewing the weapons, the maintenance procedures that you could do were done correctly and you could handle certain casualties. And it was usually a 1 to 2 day exam post patrol. And then periodically you go through an operational readiness test and you'd have people come on board, usually commanded by the squadron commander or the group commander and his assistants, and they'd evaluate the overall performance of your ship and your ability to fight your ship and also to respond to any battle damage that you might conceivably receive. So you're under constant evaluation examination. It was par for the course.
And if you got a message through saying, you know, we're doing a readiness test.
Yeah.
Would you know it's a test at that point, don't you?
You know immediately. You know immediately, yeah. In fact, in would be a manned battle stations missile for WSRT.
Right. And
if it wasn't a WSRT, it was just manned battle stations missile.
And yeah, which is the order you never want to give.
That's right. And then periodically, and this happened to me two times, I think, we got called off patrol, went into port. They pulled the warheads off, usually two missiles, put instrumented warheads on, sent you back out to sea, put you in basically an alert mode, and sent you a message, and you launched those two missiles for what they called an OT, operational test. And that evaluated the ship's ability to get the missile off the submarine and for the warheads to land where they're supposed to land.
Wow. I'd just be constantly checking. Are you sure we've got the right ones lined up here, guys? Are you sure?
Well, you know, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that goes through your mind. And you test the two-man control procedures. I mean, you test everything in that sequence. And the rumor goes, and it may be true. I mean, you know, these things have multiple warheads, but they're all aimed at the same target. And they evaluate where they hit. So when they wanted to demonstrate to the people in the Pentagon how the pattern looked, they just take a diagram of the Pentagon and draw in where the hits would be relative to the Pentagon. So, it becomes a very real factor if you happen to be in Washington, D.C. Checking the exact.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information. Now, in the UK, our nuclear missile submarines have something called the Letter of Last Resort, which is written by the Prime Minister before the boat sails.
Right.
And its instructions as to what the commander is to do if contact is lost with the UK. Is there anything similar in the US Navy?
I would say that there is. It's basically in the operation plans that each submarine carries. Extremely highly classified and basically key to the defense condition. And that's where it starts. I'm sure you're familiar with the defense condition. I think it still applies. It's a 1 through 5, and DEFCON 5 is what we're normally in peacetime. And there are, you know, it gives you the latitude to what you can do and what you can't do. And then as the defense condition goes up and gets closer to hot war, which would be DEFCON 1. So some of the obvious things are provided for. And that's pretty easy to understand. And that's not particularly highly classified. But there are documents, operational procedures, that if they get called out, or if they don't, if the circumstances are such that you can't communicate with anybody because they're not sending any message, your communication gear is good, then those are the planes that you break into, and those are, again, very highly classified. But the situation has to migrate in that direction. Yeah. Most cases, that's what you expect to happen. So, yeah, there is that type of, that concern is, I would say, the best thing I would say is that concern is covered.
I mean, it's interesting that in the UK, it's very much a personal handwritten letter from the Prime Minister. it's weird that we don't just have an operational procedure on the submarine for that eventuality, which is standard no matter who's in power.
Right. Exactly.
When you're sailing out of Holy Loch or wherever you happen to be based, did you have many encounters with the AGIs there?
Yes. Yes, I had several encounters, especially during the Cold War. You could almost count on it every time. Never really got into any situations that were where we had to back down or do some emergency maneuvering. But yeah, we were observed. We were observed.
One of the British submarine commanders I interviewed mentioned that they often time their exits when there was a football match on because the AGI would be closer to the Irish coast to pick up the TV signal.
Yeah, I can believe that. We had one submarine leaving Charleston that the crew got together and had basically a tube they could waterproof and put documents in, and they put in several copies of Playboy magazine and threw it overboard, and the AGIs dutifully picked it up, and I'm sure they enjoyed the reading material as well as the pictures.
Did you have any experiences where your training and leadership were crucial to dealing with a particularly challenging situation?
Yes, I can say that is true. It's kind of hard to explain, but I'll be glad to try if you wish. It happened when I was on the James Monroe, my first command. We happened to be just off Penzance, Land's End, and we were doing a humanitarian evacuation. And the humanitarian evacuation is where something on the shore side has happened that requires the sailor concerned to be removed from the ship and sent home. In this case, one of the chief petty officers, his father had passed away, and they determined that it was necessary and humane to bring him home. So we're operating off of Penzance on the surface, waiting for the helicopter to come out. And the conditions were very marginal. Now, if the conditions had been good, we would have done the transfer to the Hilo on the deck of the submarine, what we call the turtleback. And it would do it right off the missile deck area. Nice flat spot, very easy to do. Conditions weren't favorable for that. We had to do the transfer from the bridge, which is that sail, what we call the sail that sticks up on the submarine that, you know, makes a submarine look like a submarine instead of just a tube. And on that sail, they have sail planes. And 622 did. The class of submarine had sail planes, and they're very sturdy. And you're basically going to bring the helicopter in, and you're going to have the transferee on the sail plane, and he gets hooked up to the helicopter and he gets flown off. Well, that's how it's supposed to work. And I got one of probably the strongest, most capable man I could, and asked him if he would volunteer to be the safety guy. And we put him in life jacket and a safety harness, and we put him on the sail plane. And his job was, when the transfer person was ready to go, he would descend to the sail plane. The safety guy would hang on to him until he was hooked up to the helicopter and taken away. That's how it was supposed to go. So we're out there in this rough seas. It's very marginal. God bless them, the helicopter pilots in the Royal Navy. I don't know where they come from, but boy, they got some talent. They got some courage. I got to hand it to them. He comes in and hovers right over the bridge of the submarine. Of course, we have all our periscopes down and all our masts down. And I'm standing up there in the little cockpit area we have on the top of the sail, and I'm ducking his wheel. I mean, he's hovering that close. And the safety guy is out on the sail plane, and they send down a guy on a cable. And the first thing, the guy that they send down thinks that the guy in the sail plane is going to be the transferee. And he tries to hook up my safety guy to the helicopter. Well, one of the rules of doing a helicopter transfer is you don't tie a man to a helicopter and the ship at the same time. That's a very wise rule. We got that waved off. And believe me, it's hard to communicate because the helicopter is just hovering right over you. We got our transferee onto the sail plane. He got hooked up, and both guys are pulled up into the helicopter. And the helicopter stays there and hovers because we still have to have the baggage, the sailor's baggage, pulled up. And as the helicopter is hovering over us, and we're kind of mumbling around trying to get the baggage out to the sail plane, which we do, I look ahead, and here comes a freak wave. I couldn't believe it. And I shout at the top of the line, scream, hang on. Of course, nobody can hear me because the helicopter is hovering overhead. I'm the only one that sees it. And that wave crests right at the top of the sail. It must have been about a 30-foot wave. And when I look over the side, my man on the sail plane is no longer on the sail plane. Someone reports to the control room, man overboard, and the first action of the control room is to raise the periscopes. And I'm thinking, holy cow, these scopes are going to come up and we're going to impale that helicopter that's hovering right over us. Damn, asshole. I don't know how it happened. Man, we got the word down, lower the scopes. They did. Okay. We got the helicopter safe. Now I'm trying to look back in the wake to see if where my man is, and he's not in the wake. I can see the baggage, but I can't see my man. And then I notice that his safety harness runs down between the sail plane and the sail, and I can just, you know, there's room for that to happen. And I'm hoping that he's at the other end of the of that harness. And the next time I look over, he's actually standing on the deck. I said, oh, my word. We got him down below. The extent of his injuries was about a quarter size bruise to his knee. And all was safe and sound. And so it's good for him. But as the helicopter is now waved off, the helicopter's gone. He's hovering over the baggage. I said, hey, forget the baggage. Don't worry about it. You know, it's life. No, they ignored me. They lowered a guy down on a harness. He went and grabbed the bags and pulled them up. And so man and baggage got successfully transferred to Penzance. And so now you can't train for that. No one's going to go through that scenario. It's not in the training manual. And that's the kind of casualty that, you know, you want to have, I guess you have to kind of be ready for, because the casualty that's going to really cause you damage, you can't train for. You just have to be ready for it. And I don't know if whatever it was, I think the right decisions were made in the instance that they were required. And I was just grateful that nobody or no equipment got damaged.
Wow. Wow. When you were on patrol, did you at any point think you were being followed, or did you detect other submarines?
The question is to think you're followed. We always felt that there was a possibility, and we always checked. And also, there were certain maneuvers that could be done that you could self-check. And then periodically, there were procedures that could be done to have an outside source check if you had company. So that was a constant concern, and you tried to operate quietly. And in fact, the commanding officer has to give permission for any noise-making evolution that could radiate from the ship. I mean, any noise evolution, be it an air charge or discharging sanitaries, things like that. So from that aspect, and part of the question, yeah, constant concern, constant preparation, constant readiness. You wanted to avoid that. As to far as hearing other submarines, yes, there were occasions where we picked up the other guy. And then, as far as we know, we remain undetected. He proceeded on his way, and we proceeded on ours.
Yeah, because you were on patrol whilst the Walker Spiring had betrayed a lot of the submarine secrets.
That's true. That's true. And in fact, my duty just before taking command was on a carrier group staff where I was a submarine liaison officer. And thanks to Walker and his group, I was writing a lot of highly classified messages to the submarine operating authority, because I was providing advice to the battle group commander on how to deploy a submarine. And I'm sure every one of those was read by the civilians.
Did you have much interaction with other navies?
I did. But in the submarine force, it was only very occasional. Teamwork, I guess it was 76, which is a big operation, basically off the coast of England and Norway, involving like 16 submarines and the Royal Navy. I had the privilege of being on the staff of part of the U.S. Navy's submarine group. We reported to the HMS Warrior in, what is that, Northfield, England?
You know, Northwood?
Yeah, I think so. In the old World War II, you know, you went like six stories below ground to the center. It was
just in North London, north of London.
North of London, yeah. I mean, that was great. Yeah. Interacted with the French and the British, and always enjoyed that. Always enjoyed that. That was always a great, great thing to do. So the occasions did come by. When I operated in the Pacific, I got to meet up with some of the Japanese submarine officers. And in fact, was on board the USS Midway aircraft carrier when I was on the Battle Force staff, and had a Japanese officer come up to me and ask me, how did Midway get her name? And I looked at him and said, I don't know what you called it, but it was a hell of a victory for us. And then at that point, he did the usual Japanese expression of embarrassment, which is to suck air through his teeth, like, but always enjoyed working with other navies, but usually not in the submarine force. It was when I was operating Billis, not directly related to submarines.
Were you involved in the Fleet-X exercises when you were in the Pacific?
Yes. Yes, we got involved in portions of that because we were with part of 7th Fleet that operated all the carrier battle groups. And so, yeah, we were involved with that. And part of this staff operation was to coordinate with the Japanese, with the JMSDF, Japan Maritime Self-Defense Force exercises, involving any exercise that was done with between Japan and the United States Navy.
Right. Were you on Fleet-X 83?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to recall that.
The reason I'm interested in that one is it was one of the ones that sort of really got the Soviets on edge, because I think there was an overflight of some U.S. aircraft at some point.
Yeah, I remember that one pretty well because we had two carriers coming in, two carrier battle groups coming in from the west, and one coming in from the east, from Hawaii, and we met in the middle and headed towards Petropavlovsk. And we saw a few bears overflight, and we could tell that things were getting pretty exciting. There was another exercise we did in the carrier battle group where we purposely went into the economic sea zone of North Korea. And you don't do that without everybody in the diplomatic chain chopping off and signing on that. That's pretty closely watched. And we were welcomed with a regimental-sized Badger raid of a Soviet aircraft. So, things could get, the potential was there. Nothing ever happened, but the forces were in the position to cause a lot of damage if the balloon had gone up.
I think Fleet-X 83 was into the Sea of Okhotsk, which was sort of like a bastion area for the Soviet SSBNs.
Yeah, that could be true. I know this. I don't recall ever going in the Sea of O, but I remember getting pretty close to the Kamchatka Peninsula, and it was we were pretty aware. It was a tremendous, three carrier battle groups together and all their support ships and cruisers and destroyers is just unbelievable. I mean, from horizon to horizon, all you see is Navy vessels.
Yeah, yeah. A sight you wouldn't certainly get with the Royal Navy nowadays. Anyway, you mentioned sort of like the strain of dependence being up home.
Yeah.
I guess your wife wasn't too keen on the job that you had, I guess I'm saying.
Oh, gosh, she was a great support. I married the right woman, and we were married together, for about 4 years before we spent longer than 3 months together. And then, of course, we had a son. Wives do produce children. And in fact, if you break out a calendar and look at the submarine patrol cycle, the word was that if you were home when your wife gave birth, it wasn't yours type of stuff. And, that was definitely a challenge. The land support for those that were really in trouble was great. The Navy wise really looked after each other. And then the group was there to provide support if extraordinary measures were required. So you did all you could. And in fact, I think the best thing the wives had going for them was that they were all kind of in the same situation. They all understood the same pressures and they helped each other where it was necessary. At least that was my impression.
So your last command is the USS Alabama.
That's correct.
How did you feel on that last patrol?
You know, that's a really good question. Well, what happened was I got on board the Alabama. I expected to make four patrols, at least four patrols, and was in port. And I got a call from the detailer, and he said, Billy said, what do you think about going to Japan and being the chief of staff for U.S. Naval Forces Japan? We'd need to cut you a patrol short, and so you'd only have three patrols on Alabama. I said, well, okay, let me check with my wife, and I'll let you know. So I called up my wife, and I said, honey, I said, I got some good news, and I got some bad news. And she said, what is it? I said, well, they want to send us to Japan, and this will be my last patrol. Her first question was, well, what's the bad news? And I said, dear, I said, what's that background noise I hear? And she said, oh, I'm packing my bags. So, you know, you can tell how that goes, but the last patrol, I knew it would be the last time I'd be in command at sea. And I dearly thought the best of my crew. I always felt I had great crews and great officers working for them. It was kind of sad in a way, but then it was part of life and time to turn it over to somebody else and then go on to other things. And fortunately, I did have the privilege of going to Japan for 3 years and serving in a very interesting billet where I got to talk with a lot of not only navies, but with diplomatic staffs and things like that.
In your Navy career, did you ever have a situation where you thought this could go really pear-shaped?
You mean just go bad?
Yeah, go really bad.
There were times where I considered leaving the Navy. In fact, I had applied to a university in North Carolina and was accepted and was offered basically a fellowship that would have built up my salary simply because I felt like I was really stuck in my first command for no real good reason. It was sort of extended. Then someone I listened to said, hey, look, stick with it. See what you can do and see what they offer you. And they weren't offering me anything until they offered me a chance to go back to sea as a department head. And actually I was technically ahead of my peers in achieving department head status, and the challenge was there, and that turned out to be a good decision. So yeah, there were temptations to leave, but there was nothing quite as exciting. Well, let me put it to you this way. I always felt that if you're in the submarine force, no matter who you are, if you compare yourself to an engine and you are a four-cylinder engine, in order to do well, you got to hit on all four cylinders. And if you're a six-cylinder engine, in order to do well, you got to hit on all six cylinders. I mean, you got to just keep going all the time. You want to be challenged. You want to accept those challenges, and that's part of it that makes it worthwhile. And I couldn't see a civilian job coming anywhere close to doing that. And so I stayed in, and I look back on it and say, hey, I'm grateful I stayed in. And I also look back on it and say, how the hell did I do that?
So were you commanding Alabama when Crimson Tide came out?
I was, let's see, Crimson Tide, it came out before it was Alabama. Oh. Crimson Tide is nothing more than a war game that we, you know, that gets exercised. You when a submarine gets ready to go to sea, you put them through a sequence of messages that are received and don't receive, and regarding preparation and simulator, launch of your missile battery, two-man control. I mean, you got to test that all the time. And that's what it was. It was, very similar to some scenarios that are approached with Crimson Tide went through.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just a promise they took the name of a boat that actually existed. Because I think the Department of Defense weren't happy with the script and so didn't cooperate with the production.
That sounds about right. I suppose. in the last scene where there's the Admiral's mess, and there are two captains on either side of the Admiral. If I remember right, those two captains are former commanding officers of the Alabama.
Wow. Oh, great bit of movie trivia there, Bill.
Yes.
Fantastic. Bill, is there anything else that I should have covered, which I haven't covered, which you were saving up for me?
Well, I'll share with you. It was actually a British group of officers that came over and we got into discussion with them, making some presentation with them while I was in Japan. And one of them said, well, what were the three things you feared the most when you were in command of SSBN? And I said, well, the first one was being counter-detected by the enemy because we didn't want to be compromised. The second was being counter-detected by our own troops. And the third was having the ice cream machine go out. And they thought that was pretty good. You also asked me, what movie do I think best represents the submarine service? And believe it or not, I think one of the most authentic movies I've seen on the submarine service, especially about World War II, is Das Boot.
Yeah.
I think that's excellent. And the first time I saw it, it was obviously in German and it didn't have subtitles. It didn't need subtitles. It was that good. And one of the, you said, what books would I recommend? One of the better ones is called Wahoo, W-A-H-O-O. It's about the USS Wahoo, and it's written by Richard O'Kane, who had been the executive officer on the Wahoo and got off before it went on its eternal patrol. And that talks about Mush Morton and leadership and what you do in tight situations. But that's kind of about it, Ian.
Yeah, so there isn't a book you'd recommend about, SSBN service in the U.S. Navy during the Cold War?
No, not that I found.
You've just not written it yet, Bill.
I haven't. Yeah, right. No, thank God there's no book about it because, nobody ever launched a weapon in anger, and that was its purpose. And that makes things pretty benign. And thank God that's the way it ended up that's the way it's ended up so far.
Don't miss the episode extras such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.